exclusively for black depositors. The circular beamed with race pride and an embittered declaration that no people can well rise to a high degree of mental or even moral excellence without wealth. Blacks would continue to be dependent and despised unless they forged a wealthy class. 4 days later, though, with much public confusion, the bank's board voted 11-1 to close. Congressional committees continued to monitor the long process of attempted reimbursement of depositors for the next 45 years. But when it closed doors in July, and Douglas stepped back into his life with lasting scars, the bank owed $2,993.79 on 61,144 accounts. The affair ranks as one of the great aspirations, but also genuine racial tragedies of Reconstruction. The bank could likely have been rescued had the moral and political will existed in the Congress, especially among the freedmen's friends, to underwrite the debts and payments run up by bad management. But the Republican Party had already changed its bearings, and in the fall 1874 congressional elections, it would be overthrown by the Democrats for the first time since before the Civil War. Douglas's $10,000 was eventually repaid, but most depositors never saw much more than 60 cents on their dollar. The black farmers, washerwomen, ministers, draymen, and general jobbers who had opened their meager accounts and proudly carried passbooks had not made the hapless investments in badly managed construction firms, nor in the hopelessly corrupt Union Pacific or Northern Pacific railroads. They were the ultimate victims of this debacle, when capitalism and racism ground down a jewel of a good idea into dust. In Douglas's assessment of his short and disastrous whirl with the bank, he both took responsibility and flung blame all around. The experience was a rude awakening for the man who had striven so hard to get to the center of American political life. "The truth is, I have neither taste or talent for the place," the bank, he admitted in June, as he acknowledged the firm was not sound. But in his estimation, he had inherited and not created the situation. In early 1875, Douglas wrote to Oliver O. Howard in agony and disgust, "I never was so imposed upon by any concern in my life. It is bad enough to plunder the rich. It is worse to plunder the poor under the disguise of Christian philanthropy." In Life and Times, he wrote with both self-deprecation and anger. He confessed that 3 months at the bank made him reconsider his view of human nature. Some of those nattily attired young black clerks, adorned with pens and bouquets, he implied, had been stealing money. He blamed both the larger society's deep-seated racism, as well as his fellow trustees, black and white, who pushed him to take the post. The bank had served, he told Garrett Smith, as the black man's cow, but the white man's milk. He knew he had been in over his head, but insisted that he did not know what I should have been told by the bank's governors. Douglas was criticized a great deal in the press and in investigations of the bank's failure. But the fact is, he wrote, and all investigation shows it, that I was married to a corpse. For Douglas and his family enterprises, 1874 was a terrible year. Hard on the heels of the failure of the bank, the New National Era, long losing subscribers, went under. In its last months, as in many earlier periods, Douglas had left its management to Lewis and Frederick Jr. On May 30th, Douglas painfully informed Sprague, whose bulging family remained dependent on the father-in-law, that the boys are struggling manfully to keep their paper afloat. He hoped they would not have to let their paper fail, but I fear they will have to. By October, Douglas's last newspaper closed its doors, and his two sons were again looking for work. The elder Douglas estimated that he had lost approximately $10,000 on the enterprise. He had once again lost his personal literary mouthpiece. From as early as March 1874, Lewis and Frederick Jr. were in court repeatedly, sued by creditors, whom they sued in return over the finances of the paper. The Douglas brothers had established a firm called the Colored Citizen Publishing Company, Several black Washingtonians sued for pay never received for services as associate editors. After numerous injunctions, a judge threw the cases out of court, leaving bad feelings aimed at the Douglas Klan for years to come. In these sobering circumstances, Douglas found himself retreating to his house on A Street, a rather exhausted man wondering where next to turn. On September 1, 1874, on a fragment of paper, he penned a note of advice to an unnamed recipient, perhaps indeed to himself. "There is, for men and women, no happiness without venture." He had ventured so much in the last several years, with considerable financial and political loss. His spirits in near collapse, Douglas would, as previously, forge a robust recovery. Some of his greatest literary, political, and symbolic work lay ahead. Chapter 25. What will peace among the whites bring? The signs of the times are not all in our favor. There are, even in the Republican Party, indications of a disposition to get rid of us. Frederick Douglass, July 5, 1875. By 1875, Frederick Douglass felt adrift, frustrated, and angry. Personal losses and professional failures of recent years had left him floundering and searching for footing in the quicksand of Washington politics. Once again, without a newspaper, a job, or other forms of livelihood apart from itinerant oratory, he observed with fear the unraveling of Reconstruction from under the feet of his people. Douglass's abiding loyalty to the Republican Party and a Grant administration fraught with corruption felt more unstable than ever. His daughter's family continued to grow as it needed his largesse. His three sons once more struggled for meaningful employment in the extended economic depression. Charles especially was helplessly in debt. Grandchildren, siblings, and various other adoptees to the extended family all needed his help. Anna's health was not stable as she entered her 60s. Across the South, all but four of the former Confederate states had been redeemed by the Democratic Party. White mob violence surged again, stalking and murdering the freedmen. The man of words fell back upon his old weapon, but with a contradictory anguish reminiscent of the late 1850s. Throughout 1874 to 75, Douglass followed closely the Democratic Party's counter-revolution of white supremacy in the South, as well as its takeover of the U.S. Congress. He now lived in a capital with a scandal-ridden Republican president, and with Democrats, whom Douglass still identified with slavery, the Confederacy, and the Klan, running the House of Representatives. Grant-era corruption normally involved businesses making payments to public officials for favors, contracts, and vast amounts of railroad land. Cries for civil service reform coming from within the Republican ranks stemmed from both moral embarrassment and political fear. Indictments and acquittals, as well as the brazen corruption of congressmen, cabinet secretaries, or vice presidents, replaced the fate of Reconstruction in the headlines. With Americans deflected from Southern and racial questions by economic depression, the fall congressional elections of 1874 were a disaster for Republicans. Overnight, the House of Representatives went from a Republican majority of 110 to a Democratic majority of 60. "The Republican Party struck by lightning," read a typical headline, even in that party's own papers. In 35 states holding elections, 23 were won by Democrats. Southern Democrats especially rejoiced. They now had a right to believe, as one Tennessee politician said, that this had not been an election at all, but the country coming to a halt and changing front. The whole scheme of Reconstruction stands before the country today, a naked, confessed, stupendous failure. Grant Secretary of State Hamilton Fish declared Republicans so flat on our backs that we can only be looking up. A worried Douglass took to the road wherever invited, warning desperately of a forgetful, money and blood-drenched peace that seemed to be taking over the body politic. He demanded from a New Hampshire crowd in early 1875 not a peace which rested on one man's standing on the neck of another, but a peace which arises out of equal justice and equal rights to all. Just what kind of peace might unfold in America became for Douglass a central theme during the remainder of Reconstruction and beyond. Douglass knew the fragility of his words and feared for the future of the cause of his life. He was left to watch more than fight, as the 14th and 15th Amendments crumbled to dust in the face of armed white resistance. He especially felt shocked at the reports of intimidation and terror perpetuated against blacks in elections in various southern states. In August 1874, resurgent Democrats in Alabama used an array of coercion, targeted assassinations, and in one instance, in Eufaula, in Barber County, the murder of 7 blacks and the wounding of some 70 more on Election Day to defeat an already divided Republican interracial coalition. In Mobile, blacks were driven from polls by white mobs, and in other places, ballot boxes were burned. In September 1874, in New Orleans, in the Battle of Liberty Place, a throng of 3,500 white Leaguers, composed largely of Confederate veterans, drove black militiamen and metropolitan police away from official buildings and took over City Hall, the State House, and an arsenal. Stunned by this uprising, President Grant, who had been reluctant to take such federal action in the states, ordered U.S. troops to the city to restore order. But order and Republican rule did not last long in Louisiana either. Across the North, sentiment now ran against such federal interventions. A retreat from Reconstruction among white Northerners sent slow waves of fear through black communities. Indeed, assertions of states' rights, as well as the idea that the South should be left alone to solve its problems, poured forth, now even from Republicans. Mississippi produced the worst violence of all. Municipal and county elections in and around Vicksburg in August to September 1874 pitted white league clubs, Democrats, against a weakening Republican party, led by the northern-bred governor Adelbert Ames. Grant refused for too long to intervene in Mississippi, and by fall, some 300 blacks had been killed in political terror throughout the countryside. In 1875 statewide election campaigns, white vigilante mobs attacked and shot people with impunity in broad daylight. The Democrats' Mississippi plan used intimidation as well as murder to keep blacks from the polls in several key black belt counties. Grant's inaction left Ames's government on its own to face the crisis. Ames was forced to resign and leave the state in what amounted to a violent coup d'etat. The one surviving black Republican from Mississippi in Congress, John Roy Lynch, said that the results of the armed white supremacist revolt in his state meant that the war was fought in vain. Ames called it a revolution by force of arms and a race disenfranchised and returned to an era of second slavery. Sickened, Douglass observed the bloodshed and political transformation somewhat helplessly from afar. National press coverage confirmed that Southern violence had won the day, inasmuch as even Republican editors denounced further federal action in the South. The New York Evening Post held that no political quack medicines such as federal interference or military protection would do any good, since when troops were removed, mob violence would only begin again. The Washington National Republican offered only benign resignation. Northern people have lost all interest in the welfare of colored Southern Republicans. Outraged, Douglass responded in early February 1875 with a public letter to the National Republican. 10 years after Appomattox, he declared himself in favor of the bonds of peace and against fanning the flames of sectional hostility. However, Douglass identified 2 kinds of peace. One peace lived by a just respect for the rights of all. To describe the other peace, he returned to the old prison metaphors of his earliest autobiography. That second kind of peace, said a furious Douglass, arises out of the relation of slavery, a peace that may be seen and felt in a prison, a peace where the heels of one class are on the necks of another. The old radical found his voice again. A group of black leaders in Washington had been accused of incendiary rhetoric by some newspapers for their resolutions protesting white Southern violence. "The serpent may hiss," wrote the old editor. "The crushed worm may turn. The wild beast may warn the hunter of dangerous pursuit. But you, colored man, must not say that there is even a possibility of danger to the midnight riders and murderers by whom you are slaughtered, lest our saying so will be considered as an invitation to a war of races. Douglas must have felt as though it were the late 1840s again, when he was accused of being a black demagogue denouncing his country. This time, though, his fame and friendships were so widespread that he garnered some admiration for his spirited protests. Some papers published a portrait of Douglas as the first man of his race. The Rochester Express applauded the public letter, announcing Douglas was never more needed by his people than now as their champion. In nearly a dozen speeches in New Hampshire in winter 1875, anticipating a congressional and gubernatorial election there in March, Douglas attacked the national retreat from Reconstruction. He used bloody shirt language to draw audiences back to the war, to the mourning, distress, and desolation they had endured on home fronts and battle fronts. As Union soldier monuments had begun to appear on town greens, he gave patriotic New Englanders their due credit for answering the hour of battle and danger. Huge crowds in Lancaster, Manchester, and Concord applauded him for such tributes. To the constitutional argument against centralization advanced by opponents of Reconstruction, Douglas had ready answers. Democrats had never shied away from using federal military power when the object was returning fugitive slaves or handing over John Brown to be executed. He wondered why, if the American people could stand centralization for slavery, they could not also stand centralization for liberty. As for the charges that the new Civil Rights Act, pending in the Senate, eventually passed in honor of Charles Sumner, might advance social equality between whites and blacks, Douglas exploited the reality of racial mixture. What is social equality? They had a great deal of it where I came from, a great deal of the social, but no equality. Two races arrived in North America in the early 17th century, said Douglas, one on the Mayflower at Plymouth, and the other on a Dutch galleot at Jamestown. At that time, there were no intermediate races, but now, 2.5 centuries later, because of slavery and long-practiced social inequality, there had come 1.5 million of intermediates. His roaring Yankee audiences loved the joke. As for the election, a vote for Republicans meant protection for blacks, and a vote for Democrats meant more dripping blood of my people. Increasingly, Douglas found himself speaking at commemorative gatherings, probing the meaning of memory in this time of embittered national reconciliation. He was especially effective at calling his fellow abolitionists back to their story of greatness. In Philadelphia, in April 1875, Douglas shared a platform with many old colleagues and rivals at the 100th anniversary of America's oldest anti-slavery organization, the Pennsylvania Society for Promoting the Abolition of Slavery. He marveled at the uniqueness of a centennial celebration in such a young country, comparing the old abolitionists' modest gathering to the anticipated centennial of the United States to occur the following year. He claimed for his fellow reformers a higher, broader, and more sacred purpose. Because of the unraveling of Reconstruction, Douglas put cause above country. The centennial of 76 stands for patriotism. Ours stands for philanthropy. The nation's anniversary was transient. The abolitionists' crusade, permanent. Douglas insisted that he and his colleagues, black and white, survey a century of epic change in ending slavery and proudly tell the world that they had led the noblest cause in modern history. Generations later, historians would agree. Douglas could soar in these commemorative moments. He made audiences all but forget dire present circumstances and dream again. He refused to countenance talk of the dead past. To him, no part of the past is dead or indifferent. He took up the great 19th century abstraction of human progress, asking whether such a thing really existed. To the naysayers, he offered with exclamation the abolitionists' story. There is no more impressive contradiction than in the history of the anti-slavery cause. I know of no one period of the world's age for which I would be willing to exchange the present. To buttress the idea of progress, Douglas held aloft a nearly 200-year-old book given him as a gift in England 30 years earlier. From the Anglican missionary Morgan Godwin's Negroes and Indians Advocate, published in 1680, he took a reassuring lesson of change, since this work's anti-slavery tendency had advanced not abolition itself, but the idea that it was right in God's lights to baptize a Negro, which 2 centuries earlier had been seen as a quite radical doctrine. With such a prop in hand, Douglas asked his audience, young and old, to fight on to a second centennial. The American freedman, he said, had been given freedom and famine at the same time. Talk of having done enough for these people, Douglas insisted, is absurd, cruel, and heartless. Above all, they needed protection for the ballot. Their challenge, he told his fellow abolitionists, was to secure the results of the great moral change they had won. That summer of 1875, Douglas gave a 4th of July address in Washington that was one of the most controversial and compelling efforts of his post-war life. In the Hillsdale section of Anacostia, formerly called Uniontown, and where Douglas's sons had made their homes, a large crowd gathered outdoors in a grove for a picnic and speeches on July 5th, in Black tradition, the alternative date. Some 375 acres of what had formerly been the Berry Farm had been set aside by the Freedmen's Bureau in this section of the district. 500 black families had settled there by 1870. Following a prayer and then a 25-member children's choir singing patriotic songs, John Mercer Langston spoke, appealing vigorously for black self-help. Langston wanted blacks to manage their own institutions, singling out Howard University, where he was on the faculty, and Douglas a trustee, for special criticism. In his turn before the holiday throng, Douglas delivered a remarkable address that was at once angry, historical, anti-racist, and a confrontational appeal to black community self-reliance. In front of church ladies with fans, restless children, and male laborers with a day off, Douglas offered a history lesson. On this 99th anniversary of American independence, blacks must now face their trial as citizens of this republic, just as the white founders had done in their time. Both the Revolution and the Civil War's Second Revolution were the heritage of African Americans as well as whites. Americans collectively should be, by historic associations and achievements, all one people, he argued. Then in the form of a question, Douglas changed tone and gave the keynote not only to that day in the grove at Hillsdale, but to the concluding years of Reconstruction. He anticipated the impending U.S. centennial the following year, when the nation would lift to the sky its million voices in one grand centennial hosanna of peace and goodwill to all the white race of this country, from gulf to lakes and from sea to sea. As black citizen and spokesman, he dreaded the day when this great white race has renewed its vows of patriotism and flowed back into its accustomed channels. Proud but worried, with the promises of emancipation endangered, Douglas looked back upon 15 years of revolutionary change and darkly queried, if war among the whites brought peace and liberty to the blacks, what will peace among the whites bring? Douglas warned that justice and Reconstruction did not have a deep enough hold upon the nation. From experience and with great solicitude, the orator envisioned a road to reunion paved only for white people. A peace among the whites is a striking way of thinking about the waning of radicalism and the end of Reconstruction. The Democrats' counter-revolution in the South was indeed a successful white supremacist insurgency, a political war by whites to forge a peace for whites. Douglas aimed his speech in July 1875 directly at his own black community. He implored his people to fight back with the tools of peace. African Americans were a divided people, he argued, and lacked great men in their own ranks to lead them out of their wilderness. Langston and a few other community leaders may have bristled at that comment. In an unveiled reference to his own recent woes, Douglas lamented that the race lacked its own grand organ, newspaper, to defend and advance its cause. "We are disparaged, vilified, slandered as a people," Douglas asserted, "but we are dumb and have no press to answer and expose the injustice." Blacks lacked not only leadership, but basic self-worth. 200 years of slavery had taught his people to respect white men and despise ourselves. As a scold, Douglas was not out to make friends that day in Hillsdale. Oddly, he demanded a reinvigorated self-reliance from the picnicking throng, condemning the swarm of white beggars that sweep the country in the name of the colored race. He boldly recited a slightly revised version of the opening paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, calling on his people to exercise the right of consent and revolution, and to alter or abolish their ties to benevolent organizations. Blacks needed less charity and more justice and fair play. Douglas mocked the begging class, which he said was composed of broken-down preachers without pulpits, lawyers without clients, professors without chairs, who fail in everything but managing money given for the benefit of the Negro. The only aim of such a class, he caustically maintained, was to slip into the money boxes of these associations. Douglas hid nothing of his own bitterness about the Freedmen's Bank failure as he listed the type of charitable organizations he rejected. African educational societies, Lincoln and Howard universities, and Freedmen's Banks. It was as if Douglas breathed real-life anger and contempt into one of the central themes, the great Negro university swindle of Mark Twain's 1873 novel, The Gilded Age. They, the associations, keep the public mind constantly upon the poor, wretched Negro, said Douglas, and thus damn the whole race in pity. In the babble that was Congress in Twain's 1870s Washington, money flows toward any project with the word Negro attached. When Laura Hawkins, as deep in graft for her family's interests as any congressman, lines up votes for the black university in Tennessee on her ancestral land, she hides nothing. "Now," said she, "these gentlemen are to vote and work for the bill out of love of the Negro, and out of pure generosity, I have put in a relative of each as a member of the university incorporation." Douglas and Twain were on the same page, one with a withering Jeremiad and the other with a raucous satire. Few of Douglas's Reconstruction-era speeches garnered as much press attention as his Hillsdale 5th of July address. Democratic Party papers seized on the appeal for black independence, thus using Douglas as a way of condemning the Radical Party and remaining elements of Reconstruction policy. The Washington Gazette claimed that Douglas had urged blacks to abandon the Republicans, whereas the New Orleans Louisianan saw the speech the other way around. Another Washington paper acknowledged that the address had been shot with more rapidity all over the country than any other 4th of July utterance. The American Citizen found some of the speech enigmatical, wondering just what Douglas had intended. But it lampooned how Democratic papers were indulging in hearty guffaw and hugging, embracing, and rolling over each other at having at last received the long-wished-for views of the colored people's desertion of the Republican Party. Such celebration, said the Citizen, was merely an illusion. Because of so much conflicted public response, Douglas quickly released a revised edition of the text of the speech. He also published a letter in the Washington Republican explaining himself. Friends had written to Douglas, worried that Democrats were making great political capital out of his chastisements of black leadership, as well as charitable organizations. They especially wanted clarification of Douglas's views on whether blacks should desert the Republicans. He responded that he had been misunderstood because of stray sentences torn from their connections. He tried to set the record straight. "There is no truth to the story that I at Hillsdale or anywhere else advised colored men to abandon the Republican Party and set up for themselves. That day would come," he said, "only when both parties were equally good or equally bad." He characterized the address as an appeal to the American people to substitute the simple rule of justice for the rule of invidious charity in their treatment of the Negro, to give him his rights rather than alms. This is a prototypical case of a prominent black spokesman whose forthright statements about his people's behavior and self-criticisms were appropriated by racist forces. Douglas was a worried, ambivalent man in the mid-1870s, and feeling his sense of authority dissipating. A year after the Hillsdale speech, he still found himself defending it to the American Missionary Association. In a letter to that organization's journal, Douglas reasserted his desire for justice more than alms, even as he welcomed their aid. Above all, he did not want violent white supremacist Democrats using his words to their ends, any more than he could stomach the sectarian and selfish purposes of the hungry class out to lift the destitute Negro of their imaginations. We have watched this scene so many times in modern American politics. Current Republicans, some of whom love to appropriate Douglas, lifting him out of context to use him in service to causes he would abhor. If the political scene offered only an unwelcome, dangerous peace, no economic peace took hold in the mid-1870s either. Economic strife fueled the American retreat from Reconstruction. Both before and after the Panic of 1873 widened its swath of ruin, Douglas engaged in the great struggle between labor and capital. He was never fond of labor organizations and trade unions, largely because of their discriminatory practices against black and Chinese workers. Douglas was a pro-tariff, protectionist Republican. The high tariff on imports, he said in 1871, had done more to promote the true interests of the working men of this country than all the trade unions, eight-hour leaguers, and other combinations to force up their wages and force down the hours of labor that will be organized to the end of time can ever accomplish. Before the panic, at least, he put full faith in the market, what he called the great law of trade. Unions, Douglas believed, remembering his son's struggles, had no right to prevent others from working for less. Leaders of working men's associations, in his view, spent too much time making war on capital and advocating communism. Douglas maintained that real pauperism can always be traced back to faulty political institutions. As a true adherent of political liberalism, he argued, sometimes vaguely, that extending the franchise did more for the poor than all those who attempt to stir up hostility to wealth and encourage outrage and violence. Sometimes he simply retreated into conservative resignation on the labor issue. "The labor question is one of the most difficult and perplexing," he wrote in February 1872. "Its satisfactory solution seems to be reserved for a distant future." But economic reality did not wait for human solutions to perplexity. Douglas's vision of Reconstruction often lacked thoroughgoing economic analysis, which hardly made him an exception, even among radical Republicans. For this pragmatic, classical proponent of liberal democracy, a set of fundamental assumptions about economic life created several contradictions in his post-emancipation thought. A fierce belief in the sanctity of private property while demanding land for the powerless freed people. What often appeared to be laissez-faire individualism and black self-reliance, coupled with demands for federal aid to former slaves, denied human capital for generations. And political liberty viewed as the source and stimulant of economic independence and civic equality. Moral and political phenomena had always dominated Douglas's mind. The meaning of liberty for a fugitive slave rising to fame as a reformer, repeatedly rewritten and preached by the self-made hero, had always been intensely individualistic. Despite many pesky facts in his amazing story, Douglas could never give up on the idea that he, like others, had willed his freedom, livelihood, and future. American individualism had few more potent voices than the post-war Douglas, who struggled for creative prescriptions for the improvement of America's recently enslaved peasantry in an age rapidly growing hostile to humanitarian reform. In September 1873, Douglas was the keynote speaker in Nashville at the annual fair of the Tennessee Colored Agricultural and Mechanical Association. A huge procession escorted him to an amphitheater at the fairgrounds, where in bright sunlight he addressed some 5,000 people, not all of whom, according to the press reports, were fully attentive in the holiday festival atmosphere. Douglas offered a prolonged apology for a lack of genuine agricultural knowledge, but then delivered a good deal of farming advice, as well as brief commentaries on meteorology, insect infestation, the history of the plow, and the romance of rural life. Above all, he administered what became for him a common, stern message about the work ethic. Douglas's prescriptions were as simple and practical as, "Be sure of your water and wood," but they were ultimately moralistic and paternalistic. "Time is money," Douglas asserted, Ben Franklin-esque, and he urged farmers to maintain family peace at home. Above all, he delivered a racial historical plea to these black tillers of the soil to slough off slavery's influence, the entrenched errors and habits of centuries. Douglas's speech in Tennessee was at once a celebration of modernity and its new technologies, and an appeal to stay on the land, the grand old earth, which harbored no prejudices against race, color, or previous condition of servitude. In the post-war era, few black leaders delivered more resounding pleas for self-reliance than Douglas. To Douglas, black self-improvement had always meant adherence to the traditional values of thrift, sobriety, and work. As the years passed, he became a self-styled, unapologetic advocate of the gospel of wealth. At the Tennessee Fair, he declared that the great question left unanswered by the war was whether the black man will prove a better master to himself than his white master was to him. Blacks must stake their own claim to civilization and create their own culture, Douglas asserted. Otherwise, they would continue wearing the old clothes left by a bygone generation. They would have no science nor philosophy of their own, neither history nor poetry. Such medicine about self-reliance may have been hard to take for some blacks struggling to feed their families. In such settings, Douglas exhibited a hidebound traditional conception of history and culture. He knew that William Wells Brown and William Cooper Nell had written histories, and he surely knew the poetry of Phyllis Wheatley and the numerous slave narrative authors among whom he was the most famous. Moreover, he was not the only black journalist in a tradition now decades old. His musings on a lack of black cultural creativity were not generous, but perhaps as a way of prodding the young in his audiences, he pronounced, "The books we read, the sermons we hear, the prayers we repeat are all obtained from the white race. We have neither made books, sermons, prayers, or hymns." One wonders if Douglas knew that such a statement was both false and painfully useful. He had, after all, sold thousands of his own books, but the forbidding scold could make the pill even more bitter to swallow with invidious ethnic comparisons. According to Douglas, blacks lacked the unity and peculiar skills of other American immigrant groups, images of which he fashioned in well-worn stereotypes. "We are not like the Irish, an organized political power, welded together by a common faith." His people also were not shrewd like the Hebrew, capable of making fortunes by buying and selling old clothes. Further, they were no match for the Germans, who can spend half their time in lager beer saloons and still get rich. Blacks, said Schoolmaster Douglas, were a laborious, joyous, thoughtless, improvident people, just released from slavery. As Douglas counseled the freed people to not migrate, to accumulate property, and to create lives founded on work, he sometimes revived his older notion that blacks should be left alone to work out their own destiny. He often couched this "let alone" or "do nothing" dictum in an equally vehement appeal for justice and fair play. But undoubtedly, in the midst of the political wars over Reconstruction policy and this new age's constant strife over the meaning of activist government, Douglas's plea that the nation leave the freedmen alone sometimes puzzled his friends and armed his enemies. While his son Charles sent him volumes of documents from within the Freedmen's Bureau detailing massive efforts for freedmen's education and land acquisition, Charles also reported that John Mercer Langston and director Oliver O. Howard both wanted clarification of what Douglas meant by "let alone." According to Charles, Langston had said, "I don't understand him," and hoped that the elder Douglas would read this report and look over the statistics. More so, the son conveyed Howard's direct request, "Write to your father and give him the facts as to the condition of the freedmen in the South, a great many old and infirm colored people would perish if let alone. Douglas had staked out a moral position on self-reliance that no amount of data could dislodge, although he modified it with time and events. His position was a mixture of moral philosophy and political strategy. Too much had been done to blacks throughout the history of slavery. The idealist in the post-emancipation Douglas wanted political democracy to be laid so deep in law and society that his people could simply rise each day, make their own livings, and pursue an education in peace. But the elusiveness, even impossibility of such a peace, became a reality of Reconstruction. Douglas understood this evolving truth deep in his bones, even as he preached bootstrap sermons to his fellow former slaves. Confounding both friend and enemy, he developed canny ways to condemn sloth, indulgence, and indifference in one breath, while in the next demanding the highest forms of political and legal justice. Douglas advanced his let-alone philosophy throughout the Reconstruction years, but in New York, in May 1869, at the meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society, he had delivered one of its most forceful assertions. This audience of old abolitionists was especially pliant to the argument. They had met to push with confidence for ratification of the 15th Amendment, what Douglas called the keystone of their cause. He entertained with mimicry and raucous humor about the many times he had been called nigger, but still, by close associations or experience, had won over his adversaries. The great obstacle in front of the freed people was their poverty. They desperately needed aspiration and education. Douglas told of running into a black whitewasher one day recently. "We are great on white," Douglas shouted to his laughing throng. Then he quoted the colored man with a brush. "As to this thing you call learning, book learning, I ain't much at that. But that thing you call laying whitewash on the wall, I am there." What blacks most needed, the order maintained, was elbow room and enlarged opportunities. Humor could assuage pain and make an audience listen. So, let alone, was really a companion to its apparent opposites: protection, a social contract, government responsibility and enforcement. Douglas wanted land, jobs, and education. "My politics in regard to the Negro is simply this," he announced in clear terms. "Give him fair play, and let him alone. But be sure you give him fair play as a man before the law." Blacks needed money and a class of men of wealth. They needed leisure to pursue intellect and the arts. If his auditors or readers were confused by his position, Douglas was not. He believed government must act as the arbiter of fairness. He gave his fellow white citizens, if they would listen, their marching orders. "If you see a Negro wanting to purchase land, let him alone. Let him purchase it. If you see him on the way to school, let him go. Don't say he shall not go into the same school with other people. If you see him on his way to the workshop, let him alone. Let him work. Don't say you will not work with him." In other words, let alone meant rule of law and social peace. It meant stop killing the freedmen and denying them access to civic life. Make the revolution of emancipation real. Enforce it by law. Protect it in the courts. Teach it in schools. Keep the ballot box safe and free to defend that revolution. And reimagine government itself as the source and shield for a brave new economic world. Let alone and fair play demanded that whites open their minds and let blacks find their own place in equality before the law, announced in the 14th Amendment. Douglas chose unfortunate, passive words for a plan of social and political action. He knew this was a somewhat utopian vision, but he was in for the long haul, and he often prefaced any talk of his let-alone theory with the sobering admission that slavery did not die honestly. It had died in all-out war, from necessity, not from enlightenment and morality alone. It had been crushed in blood, not merely legislated out of existence. Its ideology and habits, its racial assumptions, lived on in virulent forms. "When those were crushed too," then said Douglas to friend and foe, "you shall have peace." One of Douglas's fullest expressions of the doctrine of self-reliance, though it is much more, was his famous speech, Self-Made Men, delivered dozens of times from 1859 to the early 1890s. The lecture reflected the culture and political economy of the Gilded Age. He appears to have carried it along with him on many of his speaking tours. For example, on the day after he addressed the Tennessee Agricultural Fair in 1873, he lectured on self-made men to the black students at the New Fisk University in Nashville. The speech was very much a celebration of representative great men, borrowing from Emerson, whom Douglass warmly acknowledged, and a meditation on success, while offering an extended philosophical discussion of individualism. Emerson's notion that all history resolves itself very easily into the biography of a few stout and earnest persons echoes loudly in Douglass. "Mr. Emerson," said the orator, "has declared that it is natural to believe in great men. Whether this is a fact or not, we do believe in them and worship them." Before launching into his own litany of models for great men, Douglass was cautious, warning of how history so often produces the false prophet. But like Emerson, who told of the sot who now and then wakes up, exercises his reason, and finds himself a true prince, Douglass cherished the underdog Lincoln, the king of American self-made men, who mastered his grammar in a log hut by the steady glare of a pine wood knot. Whenever Douglass delivered those lines, he felt their roots in his memory of the loft at the Auld's house in Baltimore, the boy by glare of a candle reading his Columbian Orator. Douglass rejected the idea of genius, abhorred the accident or good luck theory of human achievement, and above all, exalted hard work. Winners and achievers in the race of life could be comprehended by one word, and that word is work, 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 work. Chance could never explain greatness or even professional accomplishment. Only a sense of order, trained habit, and systematic endeavor could lead to world-changing ideas. He had no patience, either, with those who looked to divine favor to find good fortune. The miracle-working priest was a mere pretender. In his elder years, Douglass certainly did not reject the Bible as a source of wisdom, but he levied harsh criticisms at black ministers who, with emotional fervor, prayed for knowledge, yet they who prayed loudest seemed to get the least. Douglass much preferred to employ passages such as John chapter 5, verse 17, when Jesus is condemned to death because he broke the law and labored on the Sabbath. "My Father worketh," said the Savior, "and I also work." Self-made men was Douglass's ultimate commentary on human nature, a theme he first explored in his early two autobiographies. People were essentially lazy, Douglass believed. All men, he said with his well-honed Protestant ethic, however industrious, are either lured or lashed through the world. The lecture is at times knitted together by lines that read like platitudes in a young man's advice manual. A man never knows the strength of his grip till life and limb depend upon it. Something is likely to be done when something must be done. A laborer with broad axe or hoe needed hard hands, for the blister is a primary condition to the needed hardness. For Douglass, the greatest cause of human striving was the sting of necessity. Like Emerson, Douglass's embrace of individualism called for finding motivation, truth, and one's own character from within one's own soul. Douglass may have borrowed actual words as well as ideas from Emerson's classic essay, Self-Reliance, but Douglass's assertion of individualism was cautionary. Emerson beautifully urged us to listen to the voices which we hear in solitude, but warned that they grow faint and inaudible as we enter into the world. Society everywhere is a conspiracy against every one of its members, a joint stock company, in which the members agree, for the better securing of his bread to each shareholder, to surrender the liberty and culture of the eater. Douglass, however, chose his metaphors from nature. Absolute individual independence, he wrote, of the past and present, can never exist. I believe in individuality, but individuals are, to the mass, like waves to the ocean. The highest order of genius is as dependent as the lowest. It, like the loftiest waves of the sea, derives its power from the grandeur and vastness of the ocean of which it forms a part. We differ as the waves, but are one as the sea. Douglas's striving self was forever dramatically leaping above the waves in rare moments of greatness after years of treading water. Amid bland comments about an alleged harmony between labor and capital, Douglas trumpeted his demand for fair play and justice for blacks. The speech also contained a remarkable critique of inequality and what might be done about it in the vicious materialism of the Gilded Age. African Americans, he insisted, began life at a very different starting line from whites. Some scholars have suggested that inside the self-made men lecture was Douglas's theory of reparations. Whether we should call these ideas by that term is debatable. But his judgments about the need for historical justice were unequivocal. Should the American people put a schoolhouse in every valley of the South and a church on every hillside and supply the one with teachers and the other with preachers for 100 years to come, they would not then have given fair play to the Negro. Lacking specifics, Douglas nevertheless called for a debt to be paid over time with action. The nearest approach to justice to the Negro for the past, said the orator, is to do him justice in the present. Throw open to him the doors of the schools, the factories, the workshops, and all mechanical industries. Americans were brutally unequal in their beginnings, so act now to repair the past, Douglas seemed to say to white Americans, for you can never really act enough. Douglas especially celebrated those, such as himself, who rose from the depths to the heights of their fields. No one could miss the self-references as he honored those men especially who owe little or nothing to birth, to wealth inherited, or to early approved means of education. Particularly in America, the best self-made men were those who are not brought up, but are obliged to come up, but often in open and derisive defiance of all the efforts of society to repress, retard, and keep them down. One hears the repressed voice of Fred Bailey in these passages, and that of Frederick Douglass unleashed on the lecture circuit in the early 1840s. By the time Douglass achieved ever-growing fame by giving his special speech in so many places in the 1870s and 1880s, he had long stood as America's representative, self-liberated slave, who with derisive defiance had remade himself. In America, he claimed, men were not judged by their brilliant fathers, but merely on their own merits. 4 younger Douglases, Rosetta, Lewis, Frederick Jr., and Charles, had so long wished that this piety were true. The Self-Made Men address is an exaltation of at least the promise in American democracy. Douglas plied the depths of American mythology, sounding like the early Whitman. We have as a people no past and very little present, but a boundless and glorious future. Douglas kept that line in the speech even as it did not fit his own emerging mood during the unraveling of Reconstruction. America was, he claimed, still the social wonder of the world, tolerating no fixed classes, as did the older Europe. Douglas celebrated the overwork of Americans. He offered a flawed prediction about the future of American capitalism. To my mind, we have no reason to fear that either wealth, knowledge, or power will here be monopolized by the few as against the many. To understand Douglas during the Gilded Age, we have to comprehend why he could be so wrong with such a surmise and why he needed to believe in it. Although he invoked many passages from the Bible and Shakespeare, as well as other poets and literary worthies throughout the speech, he borrowed as much as any from Robert Burns. Scotia's matchless son of song, as Douglas called Burns, was a lifetime passion for the black writer. Burns's spirit of democracy cultivated an heir on the west coast of Scotland during the maritime threat of the American Revolution. His rebellion against monarchy, aristocracy, and all manner of convention, and especially his literary probings of the idea of equality, had always inspired Douglas. The American also felt a personal affinity with the legendary Scot, because, as historian John Stauffer has said, both men had been born poor, were oppressed by elite whites, and treated like brutes, and found in language a way to remake themselves and build a vision of humanity. In Self-Made Men, Douglas used Burns to assert the majesty of work well done, and especially to show how the lowly can achieve greatness. I see how folks live that have riches, but surely poor folks maun be wretches. In Douglas's pantheon of self-made men, Burns, like Lincoln and others, provided a model of self-education combined with a holy respect for learning. The orator's self-revelatory meditation on a life of the mind at the end of the speech is its most moving element. He took his jabs at America's most elite universities. There is a small class of very small men who turn their backs upon anyone who presumes to be anybody, independent of Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or other similar institutions of learning. With them, the diploma is more than the man. He lampooned the haughty manner of Yale boys, but never learning itself. There never was a self-educated man who, with the same exertion, would not have been better educated by the aid of schools and colleges. How viscerally Fred Bailey had yearned for formal education. Douglas worshipped books, cherished contemplation and debate. He all but lived for his next well-crafted sentence. Words and ideas were the bread and wine of his life. But always, from the streets of Baltimore to an ancient hall in Edinburgh, under a New England church steeple, or in the shadows of the U.S. Capitol, this self-made man had worried how he could measure up. A man may know much about educating himself, Douglas said, but little about the proper means of educating others. A self-made man, he well knew, would always be insecure and self-conscious. He is liable to be full of contrarieties. He may be large, but at the same time awkward, swift, but ungraceful, a man of power, but deficient in the polish and amiable proportions of the affluent and regularly educated man. An almost magical fact of Douglas's life is how gracefully he hid such insecurity. In the pivotal political year of 1876, Douglas worried less about his gracefulness than about his country, the fate of the freedmen, and especially that of his own burgeoning family. In the 1870s, Douglas carried on a deeply personal correspondence with Rosetta, especially when she moved back to Rochester with her brood of children. The peace at home that Douglas had urged upon black farmers was sadly missing for at least two of his own children. Little record exists of how or about which personal matters the old abolitionist talked to his wife in the couple's later years. But to his daughter, Douglas frequently complained about aging, about his weariness and bad health, and about the rigors of the road. "I find my continuous working power in some measure failing me," he admitted in late 1873, "and my health rather uncertain as I grow older." 2 months later, the 55-year-old confided that he had little heart left for the field, and that only the lash and sting of necessity compelled him to get on the trains. Many of the behavioral prescriptions and ambitions he recommended for his thousands of auditors in self-made men were all but killing him. So weary of travel, he told Rosetta, he often wished to stay home in the chimney corner. Only a few days before delivering the Hillsdale 5th of July speech in 1875, Douglas wrote to Rosetta of his desperation for the hearth. Such fatigue and desire for domestic peace were also exacerbated by financial anxiety. In Anna's much smaller garden at the A Street townhouse than the one she'd had in Rochester, Douglas had himself a little corner of his own to cultivate. He cherished it, he informed his daughter, as he also did his horse and carriage and my house duties. He considered the next lecture journey a positive misfortune. Instead, he yearned to remain in the same place, dine at the same table, sleep in the same bed, bathe in the same tub, and do 100 other same things. Douglas was tired and otherwise unemployed. He told Rosetta that 1,000 times he had wished that he had never left Rochester. "I've been nearly ruined financially by coming here, Washington." He looked forward to talking with his mature daughter because his affairs now made him fear the worst. Age and want are an ill-matched pair. Moreover, when one of Rosetta's daughters, Alice, died rather suddenly that same summer at age 6, Douglas wrote with a mixture of grief, spiritual sterility, and fear. His devastated daughter might not have been much comforted by her father's philosophizing about death. First, he hoped that Rosetta would not suffer from the superstitious terrors with which priestcraft has surrounded the great and universal fact of death. Douglas, who would later lose many more grandchildren to early and infant death, urged calmness. Death, he said, is the common lot of all, and the strongest of us will soon be called away. It is well. Death is a friend, not an enemy.